keep it alive through these lines I write. I keep it live cause I thrive. I might just blow your mind tonight. I'm so hyped, but it's no hype. From this height, it's direct hits on sight. I'm your type, lend me your ears to show you that there's something in me. I'm not giving up, I'm standing right here holding these days hostage, and I'll make this my year. We turning fear into love, and the love's in the air. I love doing this cause nothing compares, nothing can share that same type of feeling when you feeling them flares. They can't catch it, it's havoc. I rip to a tear, switch the scenario. My stereos, I leave them impaired. Variables start to change, and they're all in my range. I just gotta grab it, it's all mathematics. Every step is drastic, I make it fantastic. I'm trying to take your breath away, asthmatic.
This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go, go through the stereo, stereo. This is live through the stereo. Go and let it blow, blow through the stereo. I'ma let them know, no through the stereo. Yo, here we go through the stereo, stereo.
Yeah, just nod your head with it. So explicit and vivid. Every image is intricate, intimate. I put my all into it. No scrimmage and no rules. I'm a pro tool. Hear my heartbeat beat into the vocals. I'm so loco, lost my mind, oh no. It's ponderoso, dope so. No overdose, cause it's dope, yo. Man, this is house grown, mixed with some milestones. So I let the style flow down like the Dow Jones. Bringing it with some foul tones, letting the crowd no, we getting loud, so it's eardrum rudiments. Yeah, we bring it rude again. Move, little hooligan. Music for tuning in. Full time to the 10. I'm on my clock, like I told you. I'm doing this for dreams we pursuing.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Anti-Media Radio Show. Once again, with your host, Nick Burnaby, here on UCY.TV. Thank you all for listening to us day after day, Monday through Friday here on UCY. You can also listen to the show at theantimedia.org/radio from your phone, laptop, or anything pretty much connected to the internet. We're working on broadening out to new horizons so you can access us in multiple other ways as well as on YouTube. You can find us on YouTube. If you miss our show live, you can go back and listen to what we have to say. Tonight, it's 4:20, it's the stoner holiday, it's weed day, whatever you want to call it. Tonight we're on a special show regarding the drug war. We're going to have some guests on to talk about some things going on in cannabis culture. I mean, we're going to be covering all kinds of things. I've got an awesome guest in studio with me tonight, Mr. Jake Anderson, one of our awesome team members at the Anti-Media. What's up, Jake?
Much, Nick. Happy to be here on possibly the most special and sacred day in the history of mankind.
Exactly. It's better than Columbus Day, that's for damn sure, right?
Yeah, at least it's celebrating like a plant that could revolutionize the world and not America's first serial killer, you know?
There you go. And on that note, I actually wrote an article today about why 420 should become a national holiday. Now, I don't know how serious I am about it actually becoming a national holiday, but I made several points in this article that I think are really important, because it's not just a day to go and smoke weed with your homies and do that kind of thing, even though that is definitely part of it. But it's one of these things that has become like an unofficial holiday, but we don't want to forget the meaning of it. I mean, everyone else, I mean, 4th of July and all this other shit, everyone forgets what it's about. You know, Thanksgiving, it's like, oh, yeah, we're thankful for our food and shit. And then the next day, you're going out on Black Friday and buying a bunch of crap that no one cares about from Walmart made by Chinese slave labor. I mean, it's like, stoners are a little different. We think a little differently. I like to think stoners are a little more conscious and stuff like that. So how about we not let this holiday devolve into the typical, you know, American holiday like 4th of July or Thanksgiving or Christmas, and actually have some meaning behind this 420 day, because the drug war is very real, man, and it's not something to take lightly. I mean, that's kind of, I think, one of the main veins of this article I wrote today, and it's the title of it is Why 420 Should Become a National Holiday, is that, you know, the drug war has taken so many lives and ruined so many families and created this huge issue of mass incarceration. There's a chart in the article here that I included with with my article today, and it's a chart about mass incarceration, and it shows after 1970 and 71, Richard Nixon declared the war on drugs, and at that point in time, there was like, I don't know, 350,000 people incarcerated, and then by 2008, there was almost 2.5 million people incarcerated. So, I mean, it's a huge, huge difference, and that's exactly what led to this huge mass incarceration issue, which comes along with a host of a bunch of other problems. We've also got our awesome journalist on the line, Claire Bernish, to join us and talk also about the drug war. What's up, Claire?
Not much. What's up?
Oh, hang on.
Happy 420.
Thank you. Same to you. Hopefully you're enjoying it the way me and Jake are.
Probably.
Which is by not just by smoking weed.
Just by drinking Bud Light.
Yeah, Bud Light. The show is in no way paid for by Bud Light.
Nope. It's paid for by Takata.
So, Claire, you, I know in the past, and I've referenced this article in almost every drug war article that I've written, and so I want to kind of go in order of how I kind of ordered this article here, and first I want to talk about the good things that we're seeing come about on 420, and the recent developments, and you've covered this topic pretty extensively, and I think I cited like two or three of your articles within my article here, but first off, I want to talk about the Portugal example, and what is Portugal doing with the war on drugs? What is it, you know, what are the effects it's having, and what can we learn from it? Claire, I know you've written about this pretty extensively before. Can you tell us a little bit about what Portugal has done?
Yes, Portugal decriminalized all drugs across the board, like no holds barred. All drugs have been decriminalized. And they are having incredible success. They did that to deal to combat with to combat addiction and, you know, problems with harder drugs, and also to kind of stop throwing people in jail when what they really needed was help. And they put in place a sort of program where they kind of more or less sentenced people to, you know, if they seek it, if they want to, they can have treatment instead of actually being just thrown in a cell for, you know, a problem that they have that might have taken over their lives. So it's actually the use of drugs has gone down. You know, many people think that if you decriminalize or legalize all drugs, then you're going to have like an exploding problem with addiction and usage and all that kind of stuff. But that's all of that proved to be not true at all. They have kind of quashed the overcrowding in prisons and all sorts of, I mean, it has been incredibly wildly successful. And a number of countries are kind of turning to that model to look at decriminalizing, you know, either all drugs or at least some drugs. And I think that really, I think there are problems with what they've done. They have some snafus and stuff, but it, you know, they're trying, it's kind of a flagship program. So, of course, there are going to be a few issues, but overall it's been wildly successful.
Yeah, and like everyone's like, oh, well, if we just legalize it, then everyone's going to be walking around smoking dope and doing all these things. But the thing is that we found out of Portugal is that addiction rates went down. And drug users, the amount of drug users, the problematic drug users went down, it decreased. So it's like the opposite effect of all the propaganda that we've seen out there.
It also takes away the power from, like, the black market and stuff like that. I mean, it's not like, I don't know if it's actually regulated by the state, but there isn't so much of, I've said this in the past, like, couple days, when you take away the taboo, you know, either legally or socially, then it doesn't become as appealing to certain people, and it just naturally goes down. Now, they did, I believe, have a little bit of an upsurge in drug use right after it happened, but that was expected, and then that went, like, it not only did it go down back to normal, but it went way below that. Like, they've had, like, you know, like I said, like, low usage rates and low addiction rates ever since then.
Yeah, I mean, also consider that, I mean, marijuana can be used to help with far more destructive addictions, such as opiates, which are legal, you know, alcohol, which is legal, amphetamines, which are legal, I mean, and prescribed, you know, through Big Pharma a lot of the time. I mean, it's just, it's utterly absurd that something that actually has medicinal value would be illegal and discriminately prosecuted, while these other things, you know, are not.
Exactly.
Well, I guess they can be, but like, why is
it one thing is encouraged and the other thing is criminalized? It's
right.
Ridiculous, you know. And you know, the numbers are in, the science is in, the data is in. You know,
right.
Pharmaceutical drugs that are prescribed are being used, whether legally or illegally, are causing more death and more issues. More of these drugs that are prescribed are leading to addiction than the illicit drugs, the illegal drugs, the ones that are banned. You know what I mean? So there's a huge, huge discrepancy here. I mean, we're talking about drugs that have been approved by the FDA, kind of marketed by huge corporations. We see them on TV all the time. You see them on the advertisements. They lobbied the government. And like, it's also these same companies, too. This is one thing that I didn't touch on in my article. These companies are the ones lobbying to keep weed illegal, because they know that it can compete with a lot of pharmaceutical drugs. I mean, there was a viral video not too long ago from ATTN, which I think is shortened attention or whatever. But it was about how many different drugs that cannabis can replace, and there's a lot of them. It can be used for seizures. It can be used for pain, cancer, you know, all kinds of things it can be used for. So I guess this is just another one of the reasons why these profiteering companies try to keep cannabis illegal, because they know that it's going to take a chunk out of their bottom line. Claire, another article you wrote that I referenced here in my article actually talks about this pretty new study or analysis, I don't know what exactly to call it. But they basically found out that making drugs illegal hasn't done anything good, right? It's basically had no measurable impact on drug use by making them illegal. The only thing that it really has effectively done is ended up throwing a bunch of people into prison, right?
Yeah, exactly. It has done nothing to decrease usage or anything else. That they kind of, like, they instituted all these policies under that guise, but, I mean, I think we all know that it's all about control, and it has done nothing. The drug war has done nothing but explode the prison population and cause, you know, basically massive problems around the world, including, you know, we can't, you know, forget, say, foreign wars where there is an opium supply and such, because that's like a big pharma thing, and then you have people prescribed opioids over here, or opiates for pain, like in alarming numbers, and they, of course, it turned to harder drugs like heroin and such, and that just fuels the whole cycle all over again. I mean, the war on drugs has done nothing but bad things for this country and arguably the world as well.
Yeah, like the thing in Afghanistan with all the opium production out there, and they go over there and they topple the government in, was it 2001? And by then, the Taliban had actually, because it was they were, you know, against it from a religious standpoint, they were eradicating opium production in Afghanistan. And then they took a look back a couple years ago, and they found out, oh shit, opium production is now at record levels in Afghanistan after the U.S. went over there and toppled the government. And I guess it may not be a coincidence that all of a sudden, after this whole, you know, after we toppled the Afghani government, went in there and put in our own government, all of a sudden we got this Oxycontin epidemic and all these people getting hooked on pharmaceutical heroin, pharmaceutical opiates. I mean, it's not a coincidence. I mean, I don't know what these guys think they're pulling over our heads or how stupid they think we are, but I think people are catching on to this shit. And the raw numbers, the data is there. I mean, the opium was almost eradicated before we went in. We went in, now it's at record production. I mean, it's it doesn't take a genius to figure it out, right? So yeah, I mean, that's just a whole nother side of this thing. Now, other countries are starting to pick up on this kind of Portugal model. I know Ireland is another country, and yeah, it's a small country, but they're also picking up on this. And then today, apparently at the UN, there was a big conference on drug policy, and apparently there's been a bunch of news out today that a bunch of countries are like, look, it's time to end the war on drugs. So this is really good. I think that we're starting to see this big trend of people just becoming, you know, coming under the realization that, hey, look, this war on drug thing, it's failed. You know, and we're tired of the U.S. dictating policy down to all these other countries. All these other countries are fed up, I think. You know, so I don't know. It's going to be really interesting. Right now we're dealing with this era in the United States where cannabis is becoming really, really normalized and everybody's starting to accept it. And it's become a pretty accepted, you know, way of dealing with the issue of marijuana is now to just start legalizing it or at least decriminalizing it. And now there's like almost 30 states. I think the number is up to about 29 now. States and then DC as well, where, you know, at least medical cannabis is legal, and now a lot of places are moving towards the recreational model, which is kind of what Colorado and Washington have pioneered. And so we're starting to see a real shift in ideology with this kind of authoritarian way of governing, you know, illicit drugs and illicit substances. And, you know, it's really nice to see that things that I think people have known for a long time, that cannabis was pretty much harmless, it's now becoming a mainstream, you know, idea. And I don't think that it's the politicians that are coming in and making the changes. The politicians are just shifting along with the public opinion, right? I mean, I think that's what it really comes down to, is that people are starting to say, you know what, they're rejecting this idea of the drug war. And the politicians are finally, because so many people are rejecting it, the politicians finally have to listen.
Well, the drug war is simply another lever for social control and monetizing the judicial system. Now that such a big stink has been raised about it, they'll just say, all right, you got it. We'll decriminalize it, and then they'll move on to something else. You know, they'll just find some way to incarcerate more people, so that the, you know, prison union and or the prison guard union will stay happy, and the private prisons will stay happy. I mean, that's what this is all about, is just, you know, feeding the monkey. You know, that's what it is. And once the heat gets too hot, which it's getting there right now, I mean, people are just at their wit's end with it. You know, they'll capitulate, and then they'll just figure out another way to keep the prisons full.
Yeah. And so, you know, we have to, you know, this kind of brings us over to the election issue, right? And we got to look at, well, who's getting funded by the interests that are trying to keep cannabis illegal? We already talked about the pharmaceutical industry and how they're lobbying to keep cannabis illegal. The other industry that is very big in this is the private prison industry, right? Mm-hmm. And Jake, I think you actually wrote an article about one of the candidates, our favorite, Hillary Clinton, she's being bankrolled by the private prison industry.
Two of the biggest private prisons in America, the names escape me at the moment, but they both made massive contributions to Hillary Clinton. But it doesn't matter, because as she says so often, she can take millions of dollars from bad people and then still vote against them, you know? She can
supposedly.
Yeah, she has this. Hillary Clinton has this magical ability to.
She's uncorruptible.
She's
right?
Uncorruptible. She has this incredible ability to, you know, basically, she's kind of like the king of blackmail. It's like she can take a bribe and then not do the thing she was bribed for, you know,
and have no repercussions.
Yeah, no repercussions. She must have a horrible, street name.
Didn't she say the other not too long ago that she's never lied? To the public. She's like the only politician ever to never lie. Such a ridiculous claim by Clinton. And yeah, we all know that she's taking money from the Wall Street interests and all that stuff. But I mean, for her to sit there and try to act like, you know, yeah, I'm taking money from the private prison industry, but I'm not gonna do anything for them when I get into office. It's like, really? Because at least judging by your past, policy decisions and things that you supported, you know, she supported Clinton's crime bill back in 94, which helped, you know, expand mass incarceration and stuff, you know. So it's not a coincidence that the private prison industry is controlling Clinton, because I think they already know that she'll do what they want her to do, which is not in the drug war.
Is someone hold eating on,
we're,
burritos
now we're getting we're having a guest on the line that is actually helping in the fight to end cannabis prohibition. And I think Robert Blunt is joining us. He's the founder of the March Against Prohibition. What's up, Robert?
Hey, Nick. Thanks for having me on. It's definitely a pleasure to be on the show today.
Yeah, man. Well, thank you for joining us. I know you're like on the other side of the world right now, aren't you? Where are you at?
Yeah, you know, just about right on the other side of it here in Bangkok. I've been out in Asia for a couple months, just taking a look at things and soaking it in. And interesting enough, I was surprised by some of the status quo out here when it comes to cannabis policy. And it kind of blows your mind when you take a look at it, Nick, and you say, wow, there are people who are sentenced to death out here for cannabis, this minor cannabis-related quote-unquote offenses. And these are resulting from lobbyists, basically, in the United States changing the global attitude towards cannabis nearly 100 years ago. And when you think about that, you're like, well, that's insane because we're legalizing it back home and they're still, you know, basically taking people and ruining their lives or ending their lives for selling it or growing it. So it's been an interesting experience, and I'll be headed back to the States. You know, today I've started a 25-hour commute journey overseas, and I'll be back in D.C. And on Saturday we're going to do the march in solidarity with a couple different locations. We have some people in Arizona. The main march will be in D.C., and we're doing this one. We moved this one up a little bit to kind of like an extra march because we have the U.N. Assembly on drug policy that's happening this month, where we expect to see some movement or at least some identification of new data about cannabis and its impact on society. So yeah, we're working around the clock just to get the word out on that, and you know, it's definitely an effort to speed up legalization. You know, in my opinion, global cannabis legalization is already occurring as a phenomena, but I just don't think it's happening fast enough. We have people who are really suffering who could legitimately change their lives if they had this resource. I mean, think about it this way. In the United States, if you have cancer, you're usually going to pay at least $100,000 to get better. With Rick Simpson oil or tincture oil, you're looking at $10,000 or less. With traditional treatments, $100,000 or more. With cannabis, $10,000 or less. And that's if you buy it. That's not if you grow it. If you grow it, then it's nothing. It's sun and water. So yeah, we want to speed it up because there's a lot of people out there who can't wait. The patients can't wait for policymakers to design and lay out their tax system in a way for them to benefit and for pharmaceutical companies to synthesize these compounds that are found naturally in a plant. We need it faster.
Robert, I'm glad you brought up the medical aspect here because we hadn't got to that yet. We're pretty much going to dedicate most of the show here to this drug war stuff and in particular cannabis. You mentioned that there's people being sentenced to death over there in some places in Asia for cannabis, and it sounds so crazy, right? And it sounds like so extreme, but when you look and do some research, even here in the United States. One of the articles I linked from the clemencyreport.org in my article today on the drug war talks about people that in the United States who have been pretty much sentenced to life in prison, which is more, you know, it's basically a death sentence more or less because they're going to die in prison. People in the U.S. have been put life in prison for cannabis-related offenses, most of them for selling, you know, relatively, you know, bigger amounts, a couple pounds here and there. But I mean, it's not so extreme once you start realizing how bad the sentencing is for cannabis offenses in the United States and then elsewhere around the world. I mean, it's just ridiculous, man. So ridiculous. And you know, one point I wanted to bring up about the medical aspect. Now, I think one of the reasons why it's starting to resonate so well with all kinds of people, even people that typically, you know, people that don't use cannabis, people that really don't care too much about the policy and stuff because they don't use it, so it doesn't, you know, they think it doesn't affect them. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Robert, is just the amount of children now that are being helped, like in particular children with like seizures and stuff like that, that are being able to use cannabis oil, CBD oil to like deal with and to slow down and even stop the seizures. I mean, have you seen this a lot in the travel that you've been doing?
There was a young girl who's more well known as Brave Michaela now. And she had somewhere around 300 seizures a week. After taking cannabis extract, she's down to about a seizure a week, if that. You know, they would have one every couple hours, and sometimes even more frequent than that. And it's data like that. It's the proof of what it can do for our most vulnerable and precious members of society that is adding weight and pressure to our argument and to policymakers. And there needs to be a shift. You see, in my opinion, there needs to be a shift from, you know, we're not just we're asking to now we're demanding that this be made openly, available in an open source sort of way, the freedom to cultivate for family members and patients. But I think we need to eventually, if policymakers take too long to make this shift completely, I think we need to start talking about accountability. I think we need to really drag the people out who are open prohibitionists, people who are standing in the way of these patients getting the relief. And I think we need to start demanding accountability. I think they need to pay a social toll for standing in the way of the healing. How are you going to tell these children they can't have their medicine, especially people who cannot afford health care? It comes back to that a lot because, you know, I've seen instances where, well, even myself, I've experienced on three different occasions illnesses where had I not had cannabis extract, I legitimately would have been forced to go to the hospital. But I was able to treat myself for three different serious conditions. Nothing as serious as epilepsy or multiple sclerosis. But now we're starting to learn that through the hard work of master growers and breeders and doctors, that we can produce strains that are not psychoactive, and that you can provide extract to children where it does. You don't have this issue where, oh, well, I'm worried about getting them high. I don't want my children to get high, and that's fine because now you have CBD dominant strains. At the same time, there needs to be a lot more studies. You know, the history of cannabis prohibition has really put us in a situation where we haven't had the control studies. We haven't had the opportunities to find the perfect ratios between CBD and Delta-9 THC and even examine the effect of other active cannabinoids. And a big betrayal and one of the worst conspiracies of all time, it's criminal because it's a crime against humanity, is the fact that the United States government owns a patent on cannabinoids, at least as an anti-cancer. You know, it goes away from seizures a bit, but it's still an important topic. And to attain a patent, you have to prove that something works. If you have a certain type of corkscrew and you want to prove it's better than other corkscrews, or you want a patent for it, you got to prove it's better than other corkscrews. Well, the United States government had to prove that cannabinoids works to kill cancer cells to attain this patent. And they've been sitting on that, claiming that cannabis has zero medicinal value and is highly dangerous and addictive as a Schedule I drug. It's mind-blowing. It's right out of the movies, Nick. I can't believe that, you know, people can trust anything that this government says when they've lied about essentially a cancer cure and a tool for reducing real other extreme diseases. We've heard of instances where cancer patients are taking through Rick Simpson, where cancer patients are taking Rick Simpson oil tincture for their cancer, and they happen to have diabetes, and their diabetes goes away. You know, the endocannabinoid system used to be something that doctors discussed with their patients. In China, where they sentence people to death now, you know, 1,000 years ago, they were treating opium addiction using cannabis. And of course, we all know that thousands and thousands of people die from opiate overdoses in the United States every year. So it's like we're standing in our own way, you know. It's not us; it's the policy the policymakers. So yeah, that's why that pressure has to come down.
It's these people that are controlling the flow of money and information, and they've been so used to that for so long that in you know, from the 30s onward, they were able to get away with this reefer madness and this propaganda and all this bullshit. And as you mentioned, this prohibition has really put a kind of a restriction on cannabis research, because now it's so hard for like universities and people that have legitimate labs and stuff that want to do like peer reviewed and double blind research and studies and all this stuff.
Yep.
It's really hard for them to get a hold of cannabis for them to do testing on,
because exactly,
it's highly controlled. And that for decades now, it's been basically screwing over all the people that have been that could have been helped, whether they have cancer or seizures,
yeah,
or all the countless other things that it could be used for. We don't even know what everything it could be used for now, because we haven't been able to do all the research now.
Yes.
So this thing with the seizures, it didn't really come from like university studies and it wasn't some university that's like, hey, we found out cannabis can like reduce seizures. It was people like, you know what? I've tried everything for my child. They're on like 20 different drugs.
Yes.
Nothing stops a seizure. Like, I'm going to try cannabis just because maybe it'll work. And sure enough, it did. And then it started working over and over again. And now it's becoming a pretty accepted fact that, you know what? A lot of people that have epilepsy and epileptic seizures can at least reduce the seizures with cannabis oil.
Absolutely. And another really sad note in this too is we have people who are elderly who, in cases, and it's mind-blowing, would just about rather die than take this because it's illegal. And they have the old-fashioned values of, if it's illegal, I'm not going to do it. And I just see them, you know, their children or grandchildren, and I speak with so many people who have this same story. Yeah, they're on death's bed, and they just won't touch this stuff because of the propaganda, which, remember, this is all... the main vehicle to drive prohibition or to establish prohibition was racism. You know, it's like, oh, watch out for those these Hispanic people and black people. They're going to come and get high and come after your family and do all kinds of crazy stuff, come after your daughters. And it's like, you know, that is hard to explain to people the root of it. It's hard to go through a history lesson because they just get red in the face and say, no, I don't want to hear about it. It's the devil's lettuce. So, you know, the children and the elderly, like I said, the most fragile and precious members of our society, of our families, are the people who are suffering most from this. And not to mention the countless poor people, people who live below the poverty level, and people who could use this as a bulk food source, the seed being the absolute most complete nutrition source known to man, having all seven amino acids that the body needs for survival and producing itself as a biomass, outproducing just about every other living organism on the planet. It's a dead obvious solution for not just disease, but starvation. And we're sitting here because of lobbyists asking for something we shouldn't have to ask for.
It's outrageous, right? And that's why I wrote that article today about 420, because so many people, it's just like, oh, it's just another day to go and smoke blunts with your homies and stuff. But dude, this is a hugely serious issue, man. Like, the drug war, it's not a joke. It has done so much destruction, not only in the U.S., but like, look at Mexico and all the violence in Mexico. That's, you know, the cartels and all of that is created by drug prohibition and stuff. I mean, we're ruining entire countries because of it. I mean, it's created a culture of corruption in Mexico so bad that now activists that I know refer to the government as the narco gobierno. I mean, they call it the narco government now because the drug cartels and the government have like fused into one huge entity down there, and they all oppress the people and make tons of money. So I mean, it's not a joke. I mean, it's people, kids, elderly, regular people, veterans with PTSD that are suffering that could be getting helped. And you, Robert, you brought up the fact that this whole drug prohibition thing, the excuses, and I don't know the underlying issue here. I have an article here that we published on March 22nd from the Anti-Media that can kind of shed a little bit more light on it. But I know that in many ways, the way that they kind of rationalized especially cannabis prohibition, was as you said, using racism and scaring people and like, oh my God, the you know, these minority groups that use cannabis, they're gonna rape your sisters and your daughters and they're gonna do this when they're all doped up on cannabis. You know, we all know now that like when you're smoking weed, you're like calm and you're not violent, and like you probably have a much less chance of raping someone or being violent against someone. The only danger you are is like a bag of chips. Or maybe a pizza. But we got this article from March 22nd last month from one of our senior editor, Kerry Wedler. But basically, apparently one of Nixon's senior advisors admitted that part of the reason they pushed through the war on drugs back in 1971 was to kill off the anti-war movement. They were trying to stop the anti-war movement, and they knew that if they criminalized marijuana, that they could go and use the excuse of marijuana prohibition to go and lock up or go and raid people's homes, go and arrest agitators, and also to they were trying to put a clamp down on the black liberation movement as well, which, you know, spilling over from the 60s civil rights movement and stuff. They were able to associate marijuana with black liberation and the anti-war movement, and they used that to kill off the anti-war movement and to try to stop the black liberation movement. So, I mean, you're completely right. Racism is very much behind drug prohibition. But you mentioned hemp, and that's a whole topic that we haven't really got to yet this show, but I want to talk about hemp because hemp is kind of, sometimes it's the forgotten kind of aspect of this whole thing, because, you know, cannabis is great for medicine. It's great for recreational use. It's not dangerous. It's not going to kill you if you use it every day. I'm not telling people to go out and use it every day. You do what you want to do. I'm not the government. I'm not going to tell you what to and not to do. But hemp is a huge, huge other side of this cannabis prohibition thing, because, you know, hemp is part of the cannabis plant. And it can be used, as you mentioned, for food. It's a hugely nutritious food source. Here in California, I don't know how the laws go, but here in California, we're able to get hemp foods and hemp milk and hemp beer. I was actually trying to get some earlier today, but I couldn't find any at the liquor store. But that's another story. Yeah. But also the industrial uses for hemp, man, are almost endless. I mean, tell us a little bit about hemp and how hemp can benefit us.
Well, you know, how I mentioned before, you know, it's among the top, if not the top biomass producer on the planet. And it produces and contains at least 3 or 4% more cellulose than trees. You can produce three different types of biofuels from it. You can produce ethanol, methane, and biodiesel. And when you burn that fuel, the amount of CO2 that's released into the environment is equal to the amount that the plant absorbs during its lifespan. So it's a carbon zero fuel. No matter what your views are on the environment or et cetera, that is a fact that you can basically do donuts in your SUV all day and not make any difference on the environment using this fuel. The byproducts from CBD extraction, which we were talking about, how CBD, and a lot of people are learning how CBD helps with seizures and cancer and several other things like PTSD and anxiety. The byproduct from that's left behind after taking the CBD out is converted into plant-based plastics and these biofuels. In addition to that, like I had said, you know, when you're growing fields of cannabis or fields of industrial hemp, you'll have tons and tons of this nutrient source that is so complete. It includes healthy fiber. It includes amino acids and omega fatty acids, and it includes the protein that is most readily accepted by the body of all proteins that we can find in nature. And I want to remind people that, you know, hemp is a phenotype, is a subgroup of cannabis sativa. It is all under the umbrella of cannabis, but this particular strain is not psychoactive. You can smoke a giant blunt and not feel anything from it. It was used, you know, during World War II. It was encouraged by the U.S. government. They made a video called Hemp for Victory, where they were basically trying to encourage farmers to grow hemp so that they could have more material for sails and ropes and uniforms. And to this day, the U.S. government officially denies that they made that movie. And it's absolutely insane. And I remember being at the Hash Hemp and Marijuana Museum in Amsterdam. Our friends at Sensi Seeds have one there and in Barcelona, and they were playing the video on the big screen, and it's just a black and white, kind of almost seems like a propaganda film, but it's just asking, yeah, will you guys please grow some hemp? Now, that's after the initial demonization of hemp or cannabis, the first shots in the war, the first shots fired in the war on cannabis. They backtracked and said, okay, we actually need this now. And then Nixon came back, like you said, and put the final nail in it and really pushed it out there too. Sabotage the civil rights movement, sabotage the anti-war movement, get rid of the hippies, get rid of the quote-unquote minorities. And the name marijuana was assigned to cannabis because it sounds Mexican. It sounds Hispanic. It sounds foreign.
And sounds foreign.
And say, oh, they're coming from south of the border smoking this crazy stuff, and they're, you know, and so people need to know that narrative.
These guys
need to understand.
These guys weren't making any mistakes with this propaganda stuff, man. They were very, very calculated. I mean, they got the research of Bernays and these guys in this propaganda stuff, and like a lot of that old ass propaganda about cannabis, it's still sticking, dude. I mean, people still believe this shit, even though it's been years and decades since this propaganda has been put out there in many cases. But it was really, really strong propaganda, dude. And that's what
the devil's lettuce.
Yeah, the devil's lettuce. and you know what, dude? I mean, we're winning. Now we're winning the majority of Americans for the first time. I just saw a study or a survey last month that showed that now the majority of Americans, over 50%, support cannabis for recreational use. And when you ask for medical, I mean, the percentage shoots up over 60% now. So, I mean,
absolutely.
Propaganda war, they lost. They lost, and I don't know if it's the internet, I don't know if it's the activism, or a combination of both, or people just smoking it, and even propaganda, people smoked, and they said, you know what? It didn't kill me. It didn't make me do crazy things to women. It didn't make me get aggressive.
Yeah.
Like, what in the hell are these guys? I don't know what it was. Maybe a combination of all these things. But the propaganda now is falling on deaf ears, and now we're starting to win this battle. And I think people like you, Robert, I mean, you've done so much work, man. You're also an ad. You're not only the founder of the March Against Prohibition, but, I mean, you're a major player in the media side of things with this cannabis lifestyle stuff. Tell us a little bit about your work and, like, you know, the advocacy stuff that you've been doing outside of the March Against Prohibition.
Well, in the very beginning, you know, I ran into Rick Simpson. I was in some more political activism back in 2012. And we drove out and protested Bilderberg, and we were looking at, you know, why we were in all these wars, currency manipulation. And I still like to get into a brisk discussion about those issues from time to time. But somebody messaged my inbox and said, hey, there's this guy, the cancer buster from Canada, you know, Rick Simpson with his old straw hat, this old farmer guy out there in Nova Scotia who had skin cancer and used essential oil rather than smoking cannabis for a kind of a scientific approach to attack the cancer, and had incredible success, somewhere around 80% success with all sorts of cancers, from blood cancer to brain cancer to exotic breast cancers that are almost untreatable. And he was having tremendous success. And I thought to my mind, well, you know, what could be more important than this? I mean, this is something that's very serious, and I think my time would be well spent promoting this. Of course, I started learning about the history about it, and it became more of a compelling issue for me, learning about how there wasn't any demonization of this plant until a device called the decorticator was created around the turn of the century, which hemp, you know, has always been a viable resource, and people have used it for all sorts of things. It was in every pharmacopoeia around the world. As I said, you know, for thousands of years, we had a history with this. Once the decorticator was produced, or invented, the processing of the matter, of the plant matter, became much more simple, because it was quite difficult before to break it down into its constituents and use it for industrial applications. Wood was easier, cotton was easier, and extracting the oils was just not much of a viable pathway. But with the decorticator, all that changed. It became a viable competitor for all these other industries, and then you had lobbyists swoop down as quick as they could, William Randolph Hearst, the DuPonts, and get to work to protect these industries that they are making money from. And it, that really struck me as, well, that you know, I was in political activism. I looked at some conspiracy type stuff too, which is, you know, some of it's true, some of it's a little overblown, and all of it's really exciting and interesting.
Well, I mean,
stuff.
Cannabis prohibition itself is a huge conspiracy. You know?
Well, that's what I realized. I was like, this can't be real. I thought, you know, there's no way that this big of a cover up and et cetera has happened. Not only that, but how the United States, as a result of this, was able to get other countries to sign treaties. So, you know, when I learned about this, I learned the history and I started following Rick Simpson, you know, I really decided that this was time for me to grow out of the mindset that, hey, I've been growing up smoking this, enjoying it at parties. It's actually more than that. It's, you know, even when I was in Jamaica with the Rastas, they can't even believe all the stuff it does, the seizures and everything. They told me, I can't believe I've been growing this stuff in my backyard. So we've, you know, we reached out to a lot of different social platforms, a lot of different companies and organizations to spread the word about what Rick was doing in Canada. And now he's passed the 5,000 mark of over 5,000 people he has helped rid of their cancer by showing them how to make their own medicine. This is what's really important about it. Our society stands to really grow and evolve if we embrace the phenomena of open source. If we go open source with food, with services, much in the way that hotels are lowering their prices now because Airbnb, or that taxis are having to actually clean their cars and hire good workers and offer better services because of Uber. These open source sorts of things are improving our society globally, and cannabis represents open source health. So that's the main reason I'm excited for it, because there are so many people who don't have the means to produce their own medicine and their own food, and this represents an open source empowerment for people who are otherwise beholden and reliant upon an abusive system to provide them with these resources. And ultimately that helps with, you know, think of the medical system in the United States, how expensive it is to get care for anything. And if you had this as a first line of defense, we're using chemicals first. We're using the last line of defense as the first line of defense, when we should be giving our endocannabinoid system a chance. It's the skeleton key to the body. Give that a chance to heal us. And then if that doesn't work, sure, give me chemicals. Give me whatever else you got. The first line of defense didn't work. So I saw all this as just outrageous that you know, there's still large segments and large parts of our population that don't know this. So I really wanted to shift over to that. And it's been, since then, a learning process for me, learning that, you know, there's not just that, but you have veterans coming back who have PTSD. You have people with insomnia. You have people with sleep apnea and other issues that even autism, and we're hearing of muscular and skeletal rare, you know, exotic diseases that are helped with this as well, and topical stuff and all kinds of sorts. I was in when I was out here in Thailand, a friend of mine, she had a swollen foot and then a rash on her leg, and she was just really concerned with it. She had had it for I think like a week or so. And we got some of the weed that we were able to acquire out here, and we sauteed it with some coconut oil, made a salve, and applied it to her right then and there. No Thai doctor, no fuss. And in 2 days, it was all resolved. And that's just another instance of, you know, the open source aspect, which is something I really believe in. I think the future of our society really has to include that open source aspect. So that's the passion. Right now, and you know, we do business in the cannabis industry, which is a whole other aspect too. It provides opportunity for people to create a career, to create jobs. I was 3 years ago, I was waiting tables, and I had been waiting tables and working in restaurants for 10 years, trying to figure out what I was going to do. You know, just kind of like bouncing around, playing the starving activist. And I was able to found two companies. We're founding another company currently, and we have we've been providing new jobs. We've hired for Blunthouse Media, my marketing company. We've been hiring almost a person every month, and we also have an outreach program where we've hired translators in other countries, in developing countries, to promote our advertising efforts and spread messages in, of course, their native language. So, you know, it's allowed me to go from just a guy who, I just had a broke down minivan, didn't have a phone. I was sharing my phone with my girlfriend, and making like $500 a month at a dirty steakhouse in South Texas. And it allowed me to put myself in a position where I can be financially self-sufficient, and then also create jobs in the economy. And once you have these large hemp fields, once we have more industry, you know, which this is the fastest growing industry in the United States currently, is the cannabis industry, it's going to lower healthcare costs. It's going to improve the standard of living for everybody. It has a blanket effect on a community. So that's really the driving factor. We want to demonstrate, though. You know, Nick, I get tired of talking of it. You know, I grow tired of talking about it. I just want to get out there and work. You know, we're working right now on the 25th. I'm going to be touring a hemp decortication facility in North Carolina. It's the eighth biggest in the world, and we're working on planting large hemp fields in Haiti, where they have a severe food shortage. And our focus there, obviously, we're going to be promoting the medicinal aspects, but our main focus is going to be providing the crushed seed as an emergency food source. And by acting, we'll be able to produce more results. We'll be able to advocate to more governments and put pressure on those officials and start saying, look, you have the data in front of you, and you're going to be eventually held accountable for not moving on this. People are going to look at you, and your legacy is going to be tarnished and ruined.
And these politicians, they don't even have to do anything. They just have to stop doing something, right?
They just get out of the way.
Yeah, just get out of the way. Stop throwing people in jail. You don't got to do anything. Let us do the work, and you guys just got to get out of the way, right?
Yeah.
Oh man,
yeah,
it's crazy, dude. Man, really appreciate your work. We're gonna have to let you go, but first I want to give you a chance to let people know how they can join this March Against Prohibition in D.C. and elsewhere, and then anywhere else you want to plug for people to follow your work and get in contact with you.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you having me on. You know, you guys at the Anti-Media have been a great voice and a source of information for people to check out that hasn't really been tarnished by corporations and you know, ulterior motives. It's definitely exciting collaborating with y'all. This first march is going to be held in collaboration with the National Cannabis Festival in DC. And what we're going to do is we're going to march from the Capitol, the U.S. Capitol building, West Front, to the site of the National Cannabis Festival. And it's going to happen at 10 a.m. Eastern time. And then also we're going to have another march, at, I believe, 12 in Arizona. I believe Phoenix is going to be kind of the epicenter of that, but I know they were talking about potentially having a march in Tucson as well. So if you want to come out there, have your voice heard, the theme of this march is a little different than some of the other efforts. We're basically saying it's time to stop asking and start demanding. We should be very angry. There's a lot of people who've died and suffered and are continuing to suffer. So we should really be upset and put that out there and say, this is time to end this crime against humanity. It is a crime against humanity. So yeah, on Saturday, April 23rd, 10 a.m., U.S. Capitol West Front, if you're in the D.C. area, please come out and join us. We would really like to encourage our marchers to then attend the National Cannabis Festival in D.C. After that, it'll be a great gathering. We'll have music. We'll have speakers. We're going to have doctors speaking at the march. We're going to have I believe we actually have some congressmen who are going to come up and speak also. And there's a good chance that Rick Simpson's going to release a audio statement, since he's banned from the United States due to his struggles with the Canadian government. He's going to very likely release an audio clip for us to play at the march also to address everyone. And this will be the first march of many. We're going to be doing this once or twice every year, adding more cities as we go, and adding pressure until there's no reason to march anymore. It's time for people to have their medicine. I want these officials to look these children who we were talking about, look these veterans, these retired school teachers in the eye and tell them, you can't have your medicine. That's what I want to hear them say. Or they need to back off and get out of the way.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Powerful message, dude. And yeah, prohibition has been tried and failed. In the 30s, they tried to ban alcohol and it failed. And now they banned a bunch of these drugs in the 70s and now that's failed. But now they're clinging to this thing. They're clinging to it, and it's time for them to get the hell out of the way. And you're right, man. It's time to stop asking. And you know what? 420 is one of those days out of the year where everyone says, you know what? Screw the laws and all that. I'm going to do what I want to do. And that's exactly why 420 needs to be a national holiday.
Health is going open source. Health is going open source. That's what we're doing here.
Robert Blunt, man, thank you for joining us, man. It was a good chilling with you last time you were in San Diego, too, man. I'll see you next time you come around, dude, and we'll have you. I'm going to invite you back on the show sometime really soon, too, man. Peace out.
All right, buddy. Take care. Thanks a lot.
Peace.
That guy is awesome.
He knows his shit, man, and so, you know, that's this is the thing about what's going on right now with this prohibition, you know, and you know, cannabis liberalization movement, or liberation, I should say, is that it's harming people for this stuff being illegal, man. And you know, the mass incarceration to me is the biggest slap in the face, dude. But the health stuff, the food, the hemp, the industrial uses of it, it's just, there's so many angles to this that need to be talked about, that need to be expressed here. And, you know, there's just no reason for cannabis to be illegal anymore. I mean, cocaine, I mean, that's one thing. It's like, okay, you can't build, you can't make concrete out of cocaine. You can't make clothing out of cocaine. You know, you can't cure people's cancer with it. But with cannabis.
If you're on cocaine, you might be able to make clothing out of cocaine.
Yeah, maybe. But with cannabis, man, it's like there's so many uses for it. It can be used for so many things. I mean, there's just absolutely no reason. No effing reason for it to be illegal anymore. I mean, it's just
that is the reason, though. I think you just explained it.
Yeah,
you're right, though. It really is. It could really be looked back upon as one of the greatest conspiracies in history.
It is. So we only have a few more minutes, and I want to give everyone a chance to have a few words about the drug war. So let's go over to Claire first, since I got Jake in the studio. Claire, any final words, reflections on what Robert was saying, anything about the drug war? I know you're pretty passionate about this topic. Go ahead. Floor is yours.
I just think that people who have preconceived notions about drugs in general and about drug policy in general really need to re-examine what the war was founded on, the drug war was founded on, why it's still in place, and what it's done to the country and the world. And you'll see clearly that it was a huge failure and a big mistake.
Jake, floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really think I could say anything that hasn't, you know, been elucidated, you know, very eloquently by someone else. But, you know, yeah, I think it's a crime against humanity. And, yeah, I think, you know, we have to start seeing how many different people can be helped by it. And then also the ways in which it can help reform other industries as well, energy production, clothing production. There's just so many uses for it. And the fact that it's criminalized is a crime.
It is. I mean, the fact that they treat drug users as criminals, that's actually the crime.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, these politicians should be going to jail if they're supporting prohibition, because, you know, even Obama recently, and I cover this in my article too, I hate to keep going back to it, but I covered a lot of ground in this thing. I got a quote from Obama here, and this is literally right out of his mouth. "For too long, we viewed drug addiction through the lens of criminal justice," President Obama said at a conference in Atlanta just last month. The quote, "The most important thing to do is reduce demand, and the only way to do that is to provide treatment, to see it as a public health problem and not a criminal problem." Obama understands.
So then why hasn't he done
he gets the problem, but now, you know, it's got to act on it. Please act on it, dude. And it goes beyond cannabis here. Cannabis is the easiest one to decriminalize because it's got so many uses. But when we look at all the other drugs, even when we look at heroin, meth, and all these other things, they're horrible drugs and stuff. But criminalizing them, it's throwing, you know, it's just making the problem worse. We're not treating people's addiction. we're throwing them in jail and making them messed up and institutionalized and creating a huge problem with incarceration and causing the...
Yo, here we go, go through the stereo.